Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I would like to begin the show with something other than death for a change. That's just not reality in the Pacific Northwest these last couple of weeks. Yesterday, someone shot and killed a bunch of students, again, this time at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon. And we have Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Chris Lehman with us live. Chris, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
What do we know this morning about what happened?
Well, the basic facts are, you know, again, police say the gunman entered a classroom on campus yesterday morning around just after 10:30 and started shooting people. And officers responded, engaged with the gunman. They're not saying yet whether the gunman died by his own hand or, you know, a bullet, or whether police officers shot him. That's obviously part of the investigation at this point. The Associated Press reporting this morning that that officials are saying that the gunman was well-armed with multiple weapons.
Well-armed with multiple weapons. Do we know what the weapons were?
The AP says they obtained an incident report from the ATF and that the guns included a 9mm Glock pistol and a 40 caliber Smith & Wesson, also a 40 caliber Taurus pistol and a 5.56 caliber Delton.
So what are the main unanswered questions here as you follow this investigation, Chris?
Well, certainly the investigation will look into how the shooter obtained those guns, what the possible motivation there was, whether there was any kind of advance indication, whether anybody else knew about that. Again, we don't know that. That's part of the investigation going forward at this point. Obviously, the focus also in this community is on the victims, the families of those who died, as well as those who remain hospitalized.
And we don't know the names of the victims yet, right? That's always a very painful moment when we learn and announce those names.
That's correct. Yesterday afternoon, the Douglas County Sheriff said it would be 24 to 48 hours before the victims were named. I suspect when those, you know, that list is available, they will release that, because the sheriff has said, you know, he doesn't want to name the gunman. He wants the victims to be remembered. So we'll anticipate learning those names sometime later today or possibly tomorrow, as well as, you know, something about them. We presume they were either students or staff or faculty at the college, since that's where the shooting occurred. But, you know, their ages, their hometowns, you know, why they were there, that sort of thing, we have yet to learn.
Right. So as bad as it is now, that is when some people get their worst fears confirmed, and it becomes even more real, more personal as we learn those people's stories and we meet their loved ones. And I understand, Chris, that you were at a candlelight vigil last night?
That's right. Last evening, after dark, the community held a candlelight vigil at a local park. There were a few speakers, the governor and some local officials, but those speakers actually didn't say much. I mean, their words said a lot, but they didn't talk a very long time. The main part of the event was simply people standing there with candles in silence, occasionally singing a song, Amazing Grace. A trumpeter played the national anthem. But it was a fairly somber, quiet event as people reflected both you know, through words and through meditation on what the day had brought them.
Reporter Chris Lehman with Oregon Public Broadcasting, having the unfortunate task of covering yet another disastrous shooting, this time in Roseburg, Oregon. Chris, thank you for coming on live with us, and we'll be talking with you more in the future here.
Thanks.
This was at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon. And as always happens, we get a drip of details about the shooter. He seemed to be frustrated by organized religion. But as Chris said, we don't have a motive yet. We're just continuing to learn more. And as usual, we have our elected leaders, some of them talking about gun control in the wake of this. Our governor, Jay Inslee, calling gun violence a national scourge.
The fact that such an advanced country, technologically, culturally, democratically, has this absurd rate of gun violence is just totally unacceptable. And I have been willing to help move the needle on this.
Inslee said he doesn't have a specific policy proposal in mind. He did mention his past support for expanded background checks and a federal ban on assault weapons. And last night, President Obama sounded angry and frustrated and sick of shootings, sick of how routine they have become, sick of how routine news conferences like his are.
We spend over $1 trillion and pass countless laws and devote entire agencies to preventing terrorist attacks on our soil, and rightfully so. And yet, we have a Congress that explicitly blocks us from even collecting data on how we could potentially reduce gun deaths. How can that be? This is a political choice that we make. To allow this to happen every few months in America. We collectively are answerable to those families who lose their loved ones because of our inaction. When Americans are killed in mine disasters, we work to make mines safer. When Americans are killed in floods and hurricanes, we make communities safer. When roads are unsafe, we fix them to reduce auto fatalities. We have seatbelt laws because we know it saves lives. So the notion that gun violence is somehow different, that our freedom and our Constitution prohibits any modest regulation of how we use a deadly weapon when there are law-abiding gun owners all across the country who could hunt and protect their families and do everything they do under such regulations? Doesn't make sense.
So yet another call from President Obama for gun control measures. And yet again, there were protests from the pro-gun community saying guns make us safer. The head of the group Gun Owners of America, Larry Pratt, says the president doesn't seem to mind guns when they're protecting him.
The president needs to lead by example. If he thinks gun control is a good idea, tell the Secret Service, thank you, but no thank you. I'll just take my chances.
Roseburg, Oregon itself is generally a pro-gun rights kind of place. Apparently, the sheriff there wrote a letter to Joe Biden in 2013 after a school shooting, telling the vice president not to tamper with or attempt to amend the Second Amendment. Gun control is not the answer to preventing heinous crimes like school shootings, the sheriff said in 2013. On a slightly more hopeful note, a criminology professor, James Allen Fox, pointed out that there has not been much of any increase in mass killings in America.
12 kills in 1960s at University of Texas. We had I think it was 8 killed at Fullerton in the 70s. Most people really don't pay much attention to the incidents that happened long ago. They're focused on sort of the here and now and can get misled into thinking that there is an epidemic.
Again, the shooting at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg killed 9 people. The gunman died in a shootout with police. We are waiting on the investigation to find out some kind of motive, if that's possible, and we're waiting to learn more about the people killed, including the identity of those victims. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and I'll introduce my panel, and we'll talk more about some of the other top stories this week in just a moment, so stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. This week, investigators have been asking why a Ride the Ducks tourist vehicle swerved into a chartered bus last week on the Aurora Bridge in Seattle. That collision killed 5 people, all international students from North Seattle College. Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam has been covering the investigations. Lewis, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
What have we learned about the cause of that crash?
Well, most significantly this week, the National Transportation Safety Board sent a team of investigators to Seattle, and they have made a preliminary announcement that apparently the duck vehicle involved in this accident had not taken a safety repair that a service bulletin issued in 2013 recommended. This was a repair to the vehicle's front axle housing assembly, and it was issued by a company in Atlanta called Ride the Ducks International, which is the nation's, I guess, foremost operator of these types of vehicles, and sold this particular duck to the Seattle company in 2005.
And what does the Seattle Ride the Ducks team say about that?
Well, they haven't said a whole lot yet. The president and CEO of the company, Brian Tracy, has said he's cooperating with the investigators, and he wants to find out, you know, what exactly happened with this service bulletin. Investigators are saying they need to determine whether or not this was a service bulletin that actually Seattle received, or whether or not the company just somehow didn't communicate it to its mechanics. We did talk to a mechanic this week who worked on the axle housing or inspected it in 2013 and 14, one of three different mechanics at least that have looked at this particular axle on this vehicle. And he doesn't recall receiving any sort of service bulletin or safety advisory. And none of those mechanics actually took corrective action to the axle at that time.
And just to be clear, was this a recommended inspection or a recommended fix or a required fix to the axle?
This was a service bulletin that was put out by Ride the Ducks International that recommended a number of licensees and company locations take a look at the axles for 57 different vehicles, including the one that was involved in the wreck in Seattle. It wasn't a requirement, but my understanding is that Ride the Ducks International had identified a potential failure point in these axles, and that it put out this bulletin, and that a number of different locations had actually complied and looked at these things and actually took some action to correct them elsewhere.
And how certain do investigators feel that the axle was the problem that caused this swerve and collision?
Well, we don't really know that yet. The NTSB says it hasn't determined a cause and probably won't come back with any sort of determination for maybe up to a year. But based on that information and also witnesses' reports who said, you know, they saw some sort of mechanical problem with the left front wheel right prior to this accident, the Washington State Utilities and Transportation Commission took the rare and unusual step to suspend operations for Ride the Ducks International, or I should say Ride the Ducks of Seattle, pending a full investigation, which will also include inspecting all of the vehicles in the 20-vehicle fleet.
And the company has promised not to use the Aurora Bridge again. How much is that about safety versus about symbolism?
Well, I guess you would have to just take them at their word that they don't want to be involved in these types of accidents. I'm sure it doesn't help their business any, but the Aurora Bridge is certainly a concerning issue for a number of folks and has been for a number of years. And in fact, in 2003, WSDOT did a study that found that perhaps there should be a median divider between the lanes of this particular bridge. There's not right now. Some colleagues of mine at the Seattle Times took a look at some of the federal bridge data and found that, in fact, this particular bridge is, for a six-lane bridge, it's the narrowest in Washington State, and it doesn't have a divider, which is meant to generally protect, traffic flowing in opposite directions from crossover accidents like this.
And why was that median divider not built?
Well, I don't know that exactly. I know that at the time of the study that some of the potential fixes they had recommended, WSDOT I'm talking about, would have cost upwards of $29 million in 2003 dollars. And so that may have been a factor. But I know now after this particular accident that, you know, Seattle Department of Transportation as well as some lawmakers are, you know, looking into whether or not there needs to be some safety improvements made to that bridge.
Okay, and then just back to the ducks for a moment, if I could. This is Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam. Some people have asked how safe World War II era amphibious vehicles can be, but how safe are the ducks when they are maintained?
Well, that's a question for sure. I mean, from my own kind of research of looking at ducks across the country, I've only found reports, or, and that includes investigative reports from the NTSB, of three different fatal accidents prior to this involving a duck vehicle. And only one of those was really caused by poor maintenance to these vehicles. In Seattle, this particular company had a fairly good safety record. It has been operating for 19 years. There have been a few collisions here and there, but it didn't really have to do with the safety of the vehicle, but more so of driver issues.
We have the issue of drivers who are driving and entertaining at the same time.
That's right, and that has come to the forefront in since the accident as well. A number of people have been critical of that, and in fact, in San Francisco, there was a cable car tourist vehicle that crashed into a woman and killed her last year, and since that accident, city lawmakers down there have changed the rules that prohibit drivers from acting as tour guides. Now you have to have separate tour guide from a driver. Some people say that's needed here.
Seattle Times reporter Lewis Kam covering the investigations into last week's fatal collision. And thanks for joining us, Lewis.
Thank you, Bill.
Trying to find out whether that recommended inspection was made, why the state median, why the state didn't build a median divider, and whether that might happen. And apparently what it cost, he said, $29 million in 2003 dollars. So we're still gathering information about that crash that killed five people last week, all international students from North Seattle College. Now to introduce our panel, it'll be with us the rest of the hour as we learn from the week's news. Let's start with the former mayor of this city, because Mayor McGinn, you're one of those people who's been in a position of having to make choices about what to do with roads that aren't that you think aren't right.
Yeah, great point. And in fact, I was, as a neighborhood guy, I was at those Aurora workshop meetings back in 2003 that was looking at the different options. And, you know, what I would say here is the reaction here and the entire discussion of the ducks is very similar to a discussion we have after any accident. Should the pedestrian have entered the crosswalk? Was the driver paying attention? And we often don't pay attention to the roadway engineering itself that contributes to this. So, yes, we should be looking at the duck, its safety, whether it follows safety protocols. But the fact of the matter is you got three very narrow lanes, high speeds, and this potential for a crossover accident all the time. It's just a matter of time when this happens.
But what would your constituents how would they have reacted to their leaders narrowing the number of lanes on one of the few arterials, north-south arterials in the city?
Theoretically, hypothetically, yeah. No, I've got quite a bit of experience with this, and that's an awesome question. And what's fascinating is the city has adopted Vision Zero. In fact, we adopted that goal several years ago under my administration, too. Zero traffic fatalities or serious injuries. And the challenge is that we put mobility and moving vehicles as versus safety. So even when we took away lanes, as we did in, you know, 125th Street, 75th Street, a host of other places, Nickerson, we always assured the public we can move just as many cars. We don't need that many lanes for the traffic volumes on that street. This is a different situation. Are we prepared to say maybe it's okay to reduce traffic volume a little if it preserves safety? So this is a real test for our commitment to safety in the city. The reason there's no median is there's no room. As soon as you put in a median, there simply isn't enough room for three lanes on either side. You'd have to go two lanes each way. And I think that's the biggest challenge on Aurora. One more comment. Aurora, we have a hard time deciding whether it's a freeway or a city street, right? A freeway is designed much safer, clear sight lines, lots of, you know, room in case you run off the road. A city street is designed to be navigated differently. And this is neither fish nor fowl. You know, I'm stealing this from another guy I know, but This is like a futon couch, man. It doesn't work well as a couch or a bed, right? We're halfway between a freeway and a city street. These are the most dangerous roads of all, and you have to decide what it's going to be.
And part of that is because we have so few ways to get north and south. If you've tried to hack the system to get to 99 so you don't have to sit on I-5, you could say this about 2nd Avenue going south, right? One way through the city. You could say this about Rainier. It's like this is... I found a way to get where I'm going. I'm going to push it. If it's open, I'm going to go fast. How is this, what is it, 40 miles an hour or something like that on 99? And yet it feels like I ought to be able to go 60.
Because it's designed that way. The roadway design tells you to go that fast. And that's dangerous.
Also with us this hour is journalist and blogger Erica C. Barnett. She's at the C is for crank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
What do you want? You've been raising your hand.
I know.
Politely.
I've been jumping up and down over here and actually nodding quite a bit at what the former mayor has been saying about the design of this roadway and the reaction people have to what are called road diets. And I think this would be basically a highway diet to reduce it to four lanes. I think one thing that one of the recommendations that was made in the past was to add a median, but to put the sidewalk somewhere else, maybe under the bridge.
Right.
And I think that is the kind of terrible engineering that happens when your primary goal and really your only goal is to move as many cars as possible.
What would be so bad about the pedestrians walking under the bridge?
Well, you don't solve the problem of it being six lanes that are still fundamentally unsafe. You have a median in the middle, so that improves safety somewhat, but you have all these cars going very, very fast. And buses and trucks, and you don't solve the fundamental problem. You're pushing it aside. So, to me, the best solution would be to reduce it down to four lanes, and I also and put a median in the middle. One thing that would concern me about that is if the lanes were so wide that they encourage people to drive fast, because what happens when you have really wide lanes, like on a freeway, you have room to drive off the road or whatever, but you also have room for error that allows you and encourages you to drive faster. So I think that, in an ideal world, when we had the money, we would completely re-engineer this bridge. And the fact is, on Rainier, I live right on Rainier, and I live in that neighborhood. I have not seen the kind of cross-through traffic that you're talking about, Bill, with people going into the neighborhood streets and hacking the system that way.
I'm talking about on Rainier Avenue. Isn't it infamous for people speeding?
Rainier is infamous for people speeding, but what's happened is they've rechannelized the street, and actually, I think it's much, much better now, and I drive that street
once a week. Yeah. Yeah. Also with us, now, we're talking about 99. Does that make it a state issue, former state Senate Majority Leader Bill Finkbeiner?
If it's a state route, that would be funded by the state. And, it seems to me that there's some real issues with Aurora. And, if you don't have the ducks on there, you still have got semi-trucks, you still have got moving vans, all the other large vehicles. When you got them going head-to-head traffic like that, that's just dangerous. But one thing that strikes me is there's 57 of these vehicles out there in the United States. The Seattle Times reporter said there's only been three fatal accidents. Well, three fatal accidents, there's only 57 of these things, right? I mean, whenever I see one of these things, they look like big steel, what they are, basically amphibious landing vehicles. I mean, these things are built sturdy. And, personally, I think there's a problem with Aurora, but I kind of think these things should probably be held to select streets, have somebody drive while somebody else talks, and max speed of 20 miles an hour, because to say, only 1.5% of our vehicles have caused a fatal accident seems kind of shockingly high to me, not shockingly low.
Any final words, Mike McGinn?
Well, I just thought of this. How would people react to reducing a 6-lane highway to a 4-lane highway? We're actually spending a couple of billion dollars downtown to do just that, as I recall. But we can't find $29 million to make 99 safe. So it's kind of an interesting. I guess that's an irony.
Yes, an ironic last word there on what to do with a highway when we have so few of them that work for us if we're drivers or even bus commuters in Seattle. We'll keep following the investigation into last week's collision on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and we'll pick back up with more of the Week in Review in a moment. K KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and welcome back to the Week in Review. Join us on Twitter right now at KUOW and on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. That's our Facebook page, right? Social media producer Bon Huberman. We'd like to hear what you have to say as we count down the big stories of the week and try to learn something from them with Mike McGinn and Bill Finkbeiner and Erica C. Barnett. This week, Royal Dutch Shell made the surprise announcement that it's going to quit drilling in the Arctic for the foreseeable future. And all week long, we've had this debate over what it means. Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, what does it mean?
It's huge. It's what we say here is that the fossil fuel economy is starting to collapse, and it's collapsing for a bunch of different reasons. One reason is low oil prices as the, you know, Saudi Arabia tries to drive down oil prices.
Wait a minute. Doesn't low oil prices get us to use more fossil fuels?
It does get us to use more fossil fuels. But if you're Shell Oil or your company's trying to exploit the tar sands or other places, it's a tremendous capital expenditure. You're going to need a very high price to bring that to market. And you're going to need to have success in finding it, obviously. All of those things matter. And what you're seeing here is that these are really, really bad investments. Shell just joined the divestment movement. They divested from their investments in the Arctic.
Interesting. Okay,
it's only a partial
divestment.
There's a
tweet, Shell joins the divestment movement.
It's only a partial divestment. They still want to go other places. And what you see is you're seeing a collapse in demand for oil as wind and solar becomes much more competitive, conservation becomes more competitive.
You're crediting alternative energy with the low oil prices?
In part.
Okay.
In part. The data is out there about how competitive it's getting. And you're seeing a tougher and tougher regulatory environment for oil companies and coal companies as well. And Shell referenced that.
They
said regulatory uncertainty. What that means is, you know, dang, the politicians just might listen to those K-activists and then we'd really be in the soup. So they know what's going on. And these really risky, high capital expenditure drilling efforts are failing one at a time. And we're going to see more of that. So if you're invested in fossil fuels, Gates Foundation, City of Seattle Pension, anybody else, time to get out and make some money instead of losing it.
We've been talking. It's natural for us to wonder whether, after all we've been through, did K-activists and dangling off bridges and all that have anything to do with Shell's calling off its drilling? Why does that matter, Erica C. Barnett?
Why does the question matter?
Yeah, why does it matter what we decide or how we argue over who gets credit?
Well, I actually don't think it does matter all that much. I think that you will see the Seattle Times perhaps saying, gloating that the K-activists did not have anything to do with it. I think that to a very limited extent they did. But I think, you know, the bigger question is, you know, is whether Mike is right, whether we are in a divestment mode and whether it's going to become so expensive for Shell and other companies to actually get the oil that they want through things like fracking and exploiting the tar sands and exploiting other avenues of getting oil so much that, you know, it's not worth it. And they do move to other modes of energy and of running our economy. So
isn't onshore sources, that's where it's cheaper, the fracking and the onshore drilling? You have to worry so much about Arctic waters and spills, and we're getting better and better at getting stuff out of the ground.
It's pretty expensive, though, compared to traditional methods of getting oil.
That's true. You can't just stick a hose in and pull up. You have to keep going repeatedly down. Right,
exactly. Now, my hope is that now the Seattle Times will calm down about the K-activists and stop writing about the port in every endorsement that they write that are, you know, for other races that have nothing to do with the port, because their obsession has gotten a little tiresome for me. But ultimately, I don't think it matters all that much what influenced Shell to do this. The fact is that it's a huge move and it's a huge win for environmental activists and people who care about the future of the planet.
Erica is referencing an election year discussion over whether we still want to be a maritime city that brings in well-paying jobs, et cetera, with the environmental concerns being a backdrop. Bill Finkbeiner, former state Senate majority leader, we're discussing why Shell pulled out and what it means, and what's your take?
I think it really does matter why they pulled out, because I think if, you know, for people who care about climate change and ocean acidification and these issues, they got to look at what's the most effective and why things are happening. And I actually think it's totally the opposite. The reason they pulled out of there is because oil's now at $44 a barrel. And when they were originally looking at this, just in 2014, it was $100 a barrel. And I don't think it's...
And they didn't find much in their test well. Was that you don't think
I'll
that matters?
It was, my guess is that if it was at $100 a barrel, it'd be worth it.
They keep poking.
And yeah, and it's not dropping because of solar and wind. Those are getting more competitive, and they're great alternatives. But the reason they're dropping is because OPEC is basically committed to keeping the price super low because they're concerned about fracking and about people going in the Arctic. And because it is getting cheaper to extract oil, they're concerned about people basically competing with them. So they've decided to keep this price artificially low. And at the same time, you've got kind of a global slowdown. So kind of what I'm getting at is that I think we have to start looking at this environmental issue, and particularly the mantra's always been think globally and act locally. And I think we've got to start thinking like economists and actually thinking globally and thinking about what are the big levers. And, you know, it's not like it hurts to go out and kayak around the Puget Sound, but I just think it has absolutely zero impact on the big issues that are driving the production of carbon. And I think what we have to start doing is saying, how do we make carbon use more expensive? How do we tax it? How do we create a cap and trade system? How do we do something to actually start pricing carbon? And thinking like an economist, I think, and pushing for those solutions as opposed to this individual one spot in the Arctic. I mean, obviously, they'd probably despoil that portion of the Arctic. It'd be an environmental tragedy for the, you know, 20 square miles or whatever around it. But it's not, you know, whether they drill in the Arctic or they drill in the Arctic sands or they drill or they frack in North Carolina or we get it from the Middle East, if oil's cheap, we're going to use more of it. And we've got to start increasing that cost, and we've got to start thinking like economists and thinking at the great big picture of how do we increase that price.
Former Seattle mayors get the last word.
Oh, isn't that awesome? So just a couple of observations. Shell wasn't drilling on the expectation of today's prices. They were drilling on the expectations of prices 10 years from now. And what they're saying is they don't think it's going to be $100 a barrel 10 years from now, or that $100 a barrel, you know, or that they won't be able to compete 10 years from now. And the other thing is the kayaktivists are part of a movement. You see fracking moratoriums. You see nations meeting in Paris to talk about regulations on fossil fuels. It's much bigger. Hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets of New York at last year's climate march. That did catch the attention of the fossil fuel companies, and that does affect their investment decisions because that's part of the global picture, Mr. Finkbeiner.
That's former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. And finally, with a different perspective, is KUOW reporter John Ryan, who's on assignment in the Aleutian Islands in a little town called Unalaska. He's reporting at KUCB Public Radio in Unalaska. They were not expecting Shell to pull out of offshore drilling.
I think people in Unalaska and the rest of the state were genuinely shocked. It came as a real surprise. Shell executive had dropped a hint in an interview with, I think it was the BBC, that they might abandon drilling if they didn't have good results this year, but nobody thought that it would come so suddenly, that it might be a decision they would analyze all their geological results, etc., and then maybe decide whether to proceed. So it was a bombshell here.
There's been a big debate down here about why this decision. Is it the price of oil? Is it the protesters in Seattle and Portland? What is that conversation like in Unalaska and the Aleutians?
Up here, again, there's lots of different theories floating around. We have definitely heard Alaskan elected officials argue that it's Obama's fault. Basically, thanks Obama is kind of the message from the, you know, largely very red Republican elected bodies up here, that the restrictions that the Interior Department put on drilling, for one, that they could only drill one well at a time within 15 miles of each other, that was to protect walruses from noise. They said that's a big factor. But I think that's not as big a factor as some of Shell's backers would like to argue. Clearly, the big drop in oil prices is undeniably the major factor, and whether protests also contributed, that's in the eye of the beholder, perhaps.
So, John, you've been in Seattle. You've been in the Aleutians. How is the conversation about Arctic oil drilling different between here and there?
Alaska is a state that is highly, highly dependent on the oil industry, and more so than any other state in the country. You know, Alaska is really unique. We're the biggest state. It's the wildest place. It has the most coastline. The climate is changing the fastest. But the dependence on oil means that people are really less likely to protest against this industry that everybody's really dependent on. You know, in most places, people have to pay taxes every year to the government. Well, here, people get a paycheck from the government, basically from the oil industry. It's called a permanent fund dividend. This year is more than $2,000 for every man, woman, and child. So when something happens that puts a damper on the likely prospects of that industry, most people are upset about it, and it's a much smaller fraction that protest it. But even here, people did do some protests. This town is famous mostly because we're the site of the Deadliest Catch TV show. And in the off-season, which is right now, there's just giant stacks of crab pots all over town. It's like architecture or public art or something here. And protesters did put up a little sign saying, "Fish yes, shell no," this summer. But that didn't last too long before the half of the sign was torn down. So now only the part that says "fish yes" survives. So it's a bit different up here from Seattle.
KUOW reporter John Ryan, now on the ground for you in the Aleutian Islands in Unalaska, talking about Shell announcing it'll quit drilling in the Arctic for the foreseeable future. And you can hear we're still debating what that means for the future of our energy, our atmosphere, our weather, our kayak-tivizing. KUOW's Week in Review coming right back in a moment. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're learning from the news of the week, the top stories, and this week we began another experiment in letting you pay to use the carpool lanes without being a carpool. This time it's on heavily traveled 405 between Bellevue and Linwood, and we have the State Transportation Department's tolling director, Craig Stone, joining us live. Hi, Craig.
Good morning, Bill.
What did we learn on 405 in week one?
Well, we're actually pleased with the first week of operation. This has been a big change. There's 500,000 people who use this corridor. But that first week, I don't think I could have asked for a better first week, but we know there's some smoothing out that needs to be done.
Better first week, why? What was so great about it?
Well, from the standpoint, we've brought back reliability to transit users and vanpool users and carpoolers who are 3-plus in the peak, as well as people are writing us saying, you know, I live in Arlington and I got to work on time. This is really changing my life. I've saved 5 hours out of my day. This has been great. But the thing is, the regular lanes, while we had a really rough Tuesday, have actually been performing better than our kind of base of a year ago.
As a matter of fact, your former state Senate majority leader there is with us now, Bill Finkbeiner. Bill, you were saying 405 was like what for you on the east? You were there. You lived there.
Yeah, so I drive the stretch every day from Totem Lake to Bellevue, and usually it's a half hour. I didn't drive it on Monday and Tuesday because my daughter was sick, so I wasn't.
Because you were scared of the new express toll lanes.
But I got on Thursday to see how long it would take, and what was normally a 30-minute commute took 16 minutes, and that was in the general purpose lanes. That
16.
16, half the time.
Yeah. Twice. Where was everybody, Craig Stone?
Well, that's an interesting, and everybody, as I said, we have 500,000 trips up there. Everybody's got their trip looking at it. It's actually been interesting. The volumes in the regular lanes have gone up about 8 or 9% compared to our baseline. And if you look at Linwood to Bellevue, we're actually running underneath what we typically see for a travel time for that particular trip. If you look at Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it was in the range of 40 minutes for that trip.
How will you measure the success of these new express toll lanes?
Well, there's lots of factors, and the legislature's been real clear about it. They're saying, you know, if in 2 years they don't meet their performance standards for making sure that trips are in express toll lanes are 45 miles an hour or better, and it's not meeting its financial obligations, that they can be terminated. But we're going to look at the regular lanes. We're going to look at monitoring alternative routes like Juanita or 202. We will be looking at transit usage. We'll be looking at revenue. So there's really a two-year period here, and we know from around the country it can take 6 months to a year for things to settle out.
Okay, so you want 45 miles an hour in the toll lane, and it's got to raise money. Is it true that but much more than half of the money raised goes to the tolling company?
So let's think about this a little bit. We got toll facilities around the region, obviously Tacoma Narrows Bridge, 520, and it runs us in a range of 40 to 50 cents to collect a toll on those facilities. It doesn't collect doesn't cost any more to collect that same toll on 405. The big difference is that we have debt. We're paying almost over $1 billion of debt for those bridges, where 405, we don't have to pay for that. So we start doing percentages. If you don't have all that debt, people talk about, well, gee, you know, how much is my money going towards this 405? So if you follow that logic, about a third of that money does go to a company in Texas who provides us the service when you call in, when you go across Comaneros Bridge, you know, that service. And again, most of those people are actually in the University District answering your phone calls and living here in our region.
So a third of the money goes to a tolling company. Is that the right number?
Yeah, well, in that general range, so when you're thinking about this, again, about 40 to 50 cents is what it cost us to process a toll. So when the toll out in 405 is 75 cents, about that much is what it's costing us to collect that toll, and about a third of that toll goes to the company down in Texas that everybody seems to be very interested about.
A trooper said that enforcing these lanes is going to be impossible, these carpool lanes. True?
Yeah, that came from the troopers' union and does not necessarily reflect the State Patrol's point of view or the department's point of view. And we're working really closely with the patrol, and we've worked with the troopers, the sergeants, lieutenants, the captains here for a number of years. And when you think about it, they've been enforcing HOV laws on I-5 and 520 for 30 years. There's really same type of function that they're doing right now. So far, what they're doing is doing some education out there. They're pulling over about 50 people a day. They're in this traffic stream, and they're educating them with some materials, just making sure people understand how this change works. But if somebody is actually trying to violate it and trying to really get out of toll evasion, they will issue a ticket for that.
You're listening to the State Transportation Department's tolling director, Craig Stone. Will you stay on the line and listen to our panel react, and maybe you can react back?
I'd love to.
Okay, journalist Erica C. Barnett, you're always weighing in against regressive taxes. These are Lexus lanes, right? These are you. If you have the money, you can cruise along on 405, and if you don't, you're out of luck?
I guess I would respond that 75 cents is quite a bit lower than, say, bus fare. So if you want to call that Lexus lanes, and I guess buses are like Bentley lanes. so I completely, of course, obviously disagree that they are Lexus lanes. They are paying for the privilege of being able to go faster than everybody else on the road. And, you know, one reason these lanes were added was because when they were expanding 405, I think from Bothell to Bellevue, they decided this was sort of a compromise. You know, we're going to make the road bigger, but we're going to add an HOV / tolling lane. And, you know, to me, that was kind of a lesser of two evils kind of deal. And, you know, it does make traffic move faster. That's not the biggest benefit in my mind, but it obviously, you know, Bill's anecdotal example of being able to get his route done in 16 minutes. I mean, there's going to be some bumps at the beginning, but I think that ultimately everybody will work it out. We're used to tolls in this region. It's not a new technology. So give it a little time.
Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, what's your take?
I think I'm in the wrong business. A third of the money goes to tolling. You know, I've got to really, really reconsider how I think about highways. That's my take.
Really? Bill Finkbeiner, you said the things have worked out just fine, but I got to say, I guess this is for Craig Stone. I have heard some people complain that they feel like they're being put over a barrel, that they're, that you're squeezing them. You're gonna reduce the lanes, make it harder for them to get to work unless they pay, and that feels unjust. What do you say?
Well, this is part of what we all deal with in public policy, and obviously those that have been here on your phone call have been, you know, in elected positions have to deal with this. You know, in my career, we've doubled the growth of the state of Washington, the population. We have incredible growth here. What's happening? We just put general purpose lanes out there. They would fill up, and we would be in stop-and-go conditions. So we've looked at light rail. We've looked at different things. I agree with the comment. This is somewhat of a compromise. We want to return back to transit reliability. We have Sound Transit buses, community transit buses, metro buses going up and down the corridor. Those people are now getting a very fast trip. Vanpools is our second priority for those lanes. They're getting a great trip. The 3-plus carpools are in there. You'll start seeing some more formed. But we're also giving a choice now to the individual solo driver that says, if I got to get there, I got to get to that appointment, I got to get to the airport, they have a choice. I live in Renton. I, you know, used to work in Bellevue. I had no choice to use that HOV lane without getting a ticket. Now, on this Bothell, you know, this area here between Linwood and Bellevue, least we're giving them people, those people a choice.
What's so bad about carpooling? We're all acting like, oh, like we at least finally we have some alternative to carpooling.
I think David.
Do we hate each other?
I think David makes some great points about how you just can't build enough highways to solve it, and they're searching for other things.
Craig Stone is your state tolling director. Craig, thank you for that.
No problem.
I mean, I think there's a couple things going on here, too. I think, first of all, that 75 cents is going to start shooting up because I think after Tuesday was so bad, what happened is everybody went to the arterial. So I don't think it's working out perfectly because I took an arterial home last night, and that was backed up at 4 o'clock for probably a mile further than it usually is.
Bringing you anecdotal evidence, this is KUOW, Seattle.
He's also the only one who actually drives out there. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah, you're the only. You were the only one.
I'm on my bike. He's out there, man.
Yeah. Weird driving. You're weird. I'm with you, Brother Finkbeiner.
Right on. Somebody's out there.
Motorcycles, by the way, can drive for free in the toll lanes.
Good
FYI.
Point. Thank you.
A little public service from the C is for Crank.
Two-wheeler, Erica C. Barnett. The C is for carburetor. and finally, last word. They're monitoring how this. You know, it is still an experiment. They're going to do this for 2 years on 405 and see if speeds are up and money raised is up. Right back to finish up the Week in Review. Stay tuned. Mike McGinn, Bill Finkbeiner, Erica C. Barnett, and I'm Bill Radke. Rounding up the Week in Review. This week, the Seattle Mariners got a new general manager. They fired the last one after seven consecutive seasons of no playoffs. The new guy, Jerry DePoto, was most recently with the Anaheim Angels. And what is his approach to baseball?
I've often described myself as the kid who sits on the floor with a bucket of Legos. And I want to build the prettiest castle that can be built. And until the last block is in the castle, I won't settle.
Mariners built like Legos, as opposed to the House of Cards construction that we have had up to now. Seattle Times Mariners reporter Jeff Baker, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be on.
Good to have you. What makes us think the new Lego castle will be any prettier than the last 14?
Well, there is nothing that really indicates that it will be. I mean, as of right now, I mean, we've heard a lot of nice statements made before at the beginning of a general manager's tenure. It's what happens in the next couple of years afterwards that's going to determine it. On the positive side, it can't get much worse than it did the last 7 years under Jack Sorensic. You have a team now that's headed towards about 85 losses, and that's about what they've averaged over the 7 years that he was in charge. So now you have DePoto coming on, and the one advantage he has over Zarensic is that the team he's taking over now does have a lot of good pieces in it. You've got Nelson Cruz, you've got Robinson Cano, Kyle Seager, Felix Hernandez. Those are all players that the team's ownership has committed significant amounts of dollars to for several years to come. Back when Jack Zarensic took over the team in late 2008, beginning of 2009, they were really shedding a whole bunch of those salaries. They were cutting payroll. They had a bunch of untested players. So you have a much better core in place now, and I think that's why there's a lot of expectation on the new GM, Jerry DePoto, to get this thing turned around a lot quicker. He's been given a much higher payroll by ownership. It's still not enough for the Mariners to contend, obviously. I mean, that's seen in black and white in the results. But, you know, there's a thought that with a few moves here or there, a better balancing of the roster depth, that they are going to be able to be competitive as quickly as next season. And that's you know, entirely possible because they let more teams in the playoffs these days. It's a lot easier to contend than it used to be 3 or 4 years ago.
And how is this new general manager supposed to help the Mariners?
Well, he's a little more versed in advanced metrics.
Advanced metrics.
Not an expert in that. He's a former pitcher, background in scouting, but you know, he relies heavily on other people who are very well versed in advanced metrics, in looking for hidden value in players, and he's expected to rely very heavily on those and finding some of the hidden talent out there that might not cost this team a whole lot of money, but can give them the value and the depth that they need. I mean, you know, this team's already committed about $130 million to the payroll, and it's not going to go down next year. I mean, really, to contend at this rate, the rate they're spending, they're going to have to spend at least about $150 million to even have a shot at contending. So if you can find some bargains in there that might knock that price down a little, that could help because it's not going to be an easy task. They've got a lot of money committed to about four or five key players, and there's 25 on a roster, so you're going to have to find some bargains somewhere.
What is it about the Mariners? Why have they been so weak for so long?
I mean, one of the things which I identified in the newspaper today is that they've had very little continuity between their general manager and their manager, meaning they haven't had the same manager and general manager together for more than 3 years, going all the way back to the late 1990s, and they're the only team in baseball that can say that. Every other franchise in baseball has had at least a four-year pairing between the GM and the manager, and that's a result of picking the wrong guys, quite frankly. You know, it's not a matter of leaving two guys together for long periods of time. You're going to have to change things up when you're losing and when you pick the wrong guys, and the problem is the Mariners keep picking the wrong guys. They keep picking the wrong guy for GM, and then the general manager doesn't last more than about 5 years, which is, you know, not very long in terms of general managers, and their managers never last more than 2 or 3 years here because they keep getting fired by the general managers. And so you're going to have to find whoever Jerry DePoto picks to be his manager, whether he keeps Lloyd McClendon or he gets a new guy, he's going to have to know inside his mind, all right, I firmly believe I can stay with this guy for a good 4 or 5 years down the road. If he's got any doubts that he's going to have McClendon around in another year or two, he can't retain him, because you can't keep changing the manager every 2 or 3 years in this town, or every year or two, because it just throws the players off. It throws the entire system into disarray. You're going to have to establish continuity, get a system that everybody from the minor leagues on up to the major leagues can follow, and then follow through with it and execute your plan. And that's something the Mariners haven't been able to do since the days of going back to even Pat Gillick and beyond that.
Yes, we know we're at it. Jeff, I'm sorry, we're out of time at the end of this hour. Reporter Jeff Baker with the Seattle Times getting worked up about Mariner futility. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, good talking.
So get the right Lego piece in place and keep it there. Mike McGinn, Bill Finkbeiner, Erica C. Barnett, thank you all.
Thank you.
The C is for crank, the M is for mayor, the Finkbeiner is for former majority leader. Thanks for joining us. And Jason Pagano and Bernard Ouellette, thanks for putting the show together.